1965 College Player of the Year by the National Association of Basketball Coaches. He turned down a contract with the New York Knicks to accept a Rhodes Scholarship. In 1967, after completing the scholarship, he joined the Knicks, with whom he played for 10 seasons. He retired from basketball in 1977, ran for office in 78, and in 1979 was sworn in as the Senate's youngest member. Since that time, he served on the Energy and Finance Committees. Bradley is the co-sponsor of the Fair Tax Bill, a tax reform proposal, was an architect of the windfall profits tax on oil, and is currently seeking Medicare reforms. He helped bring a major contract to the Philadelphia Navy Yard and was instrumental in persuading the Army not to close the Basic Training Center at Fort Dix, New Jersey. The liberal group, the Americans for Democratic Action, the ADA, gave him a 100% rating in their 1982 voting records. The American Conservative Union rated his voting record 15%. We hope to open up the phones for your questions and comments during the second half of our talk. I want to welcome you to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Terry. Good to be with you.
After you retired from basketball, you were elected to the Senate. What were your other options when you were considering what to do after sports retirement?
Well, I thought the natural range of journalism and business and finance, and felt that what I really wanted to do was to make a contribution to improve the quality of life in the country, and that based on 10 years of playing and using the off seasons to try to test my strengths and weaknesses, that the best place to do that would be an elective office.
I think some people start off idealistically when they enter into politics and want to make a contribution and change things, and find themselves getting increasingly cynical as they remain in politics. How would you evaluate your cynicism level now that you've been in it for several years?
Well, I am not a cynic. I am, I guess, an optimist, because I have a kind of basic underlying belief in the institutions of the country that our founding fathers drafted and that remain remarkably alive and flexible today. And also because, as U.S. Senator from New Jersey, I am out among my constituents a great deal in town meetings and in conferences and greeting them in various places. And I find a tremendous reservoir of hope among my constituents. They want things to be better. They're willing to make the necessary changes in their own lives to make those things better. And so I am not a cynic at all. I think that we're a country that has a real potential ahead of us, not just a country with an outstanding past.
Your father was a Republican. Was it a dramatic move in the family when you became a Democrat?
No, it wasn't. In fact, I think my father now votes more Democratic than Republican. So in a small sense, it was a triumph for me that I was able to move him at least to the independent side.
Many journalists have referred to you as a neoliberal. I wonder what you think of that word and that category that's been used to describe people like yourself, Gary Hart. Who else? Paul Tsongas would come under that category.
Well, I've always thought that I was more interested in people than computer terminals. And the image of a neoliberal is one that is, I think, shaped in part by a commitment to a high-tech future, which, of course, I have. But I think that it depends on what you mean by neoliberal. If you mean simply computer terminals over human feelings and people programs, no, I'm not that. But if what it means is that you are committed to try to develop a new agenda for the 80s and 90s for the party and for the country, then yes, very much I'm a part of that and want to be a part of that.
What do you see that new agenda as being?
Well, I think the first and foremost thing is a tax system that is fair with as low rates as possible. I think that that is the core to any kind of long-term change in the country. And to that end, I've proposed the Fair Tax Bill, along with Congressman Gephardt in the House, which would drop tax rates to a range of 14% to 30%, and 80% of the people would be paying no more than 14% in tax. The second thing it would do is raise the amount of income that a person can earn before they have to pay any taxes. A family with two children would have to earn over $11,200 before they got their first dollar of taxable income. And third, we eliminate most of the loopholes that have been used by some people to avoid paying tax over the years, keeping those such as home mortgage interest and charitable contributions and property tax deductions and a few others that are used by middle-income people. With this approach, lower tax rates for everybody, fewer loopholes for some people, and a higher amount you can earn before you get any taxable income, you can raise the same amount of revenue. I happen to think that it combines both the growth aspect of lower tax rates with the equity aspect of fewer loopholes. And I think that's a central plank in any kind of new agenda for the country and certainly for the Democratic Party. And right here in Philadelphia at the midterm convention in 1982, the Democrats endorsed such a tax approach. Beyond taxes, I think that we need a basic and firm commitment to arms control, to a clean environment, to a much better and aggressively active educational system. And I think that we need to recognize that full employment in this country is going to come only as we compete effectively in a stable world economy. All of those are issues that I think should be on any agenda for future action for Democrats, Republicans, for Americans. Because, I mean, I don't think we have a Republican or a Democratic economy. I think we have an American economy. And I think that all of those issues affect that economy and affect the quality of life in this country. And I might add another, and that is, seems strange that you have to do that in the 1980s, but I think it's always necessary just to underline a basic commitment to civil rights.
We're being told now that we're in an economic upswing and that unemployment levels are starting to decrease. Does that strike you as being true? And if so, to what do you attribute it?
Well, a little bit. In anything in economics, there are good signs and bad signs. And clearly, we have a recovery in progress. I still don't know how robust that recovery will be. There are some good signs. Inflation is down. The interest rates have dropped, although they've blipped back up a point and a half in the last 6 weeks. But there are still to be some continuing worries out there. Unemployment is still high. It's over 10% nationwide. It's higher than that if you take those people who've dropped off the unemployment rolls. The deficits are over $200 billion. I mean, it took from the beginning of the country until 1980 to accumulate a national debt that totaled $1 trillion and will double that in the next 5 years. Those are troubling signs. You take retail sales, they're not growing. They're more than about 2.5%. No recovery in the post-war period has had such a low consumer spending level. And so, you know, there are some real concerns out there. As I said initially, I prefer to be the optimist, and I hope we are in a sustained recovery, but I think that that is not going to come unless we're able to address the deficits, particularly in the fiscal year 1986, which really comes in the calendar year 1985. If we're able to do that, if we're able to get the budget resolution that was supported in the Senate on a bipartisan basis, I think that we actually could be in a reasonable recovery when all of the issues that I talked about earlier about the agenda would then really be important and really be on the front burner, because the issue wouldn't be where are we in the cyclical process of recovery and recession.
Since Reagan entered the White House, Democrats have been wondering what the Democrats are going to do to get into a powerful position for the upcoming presidential election. And I think there's been a debate amongst Democrats about whether the American public would like to see them become a little more conservative or more liberal, more radical even. What do you think? Is that a debate that's happening now? And what do you think would be a better solution?
Well, I think that different people will define liberal, radical, conservative in different ways. And that's why I prefer to address very specific issues. I think that you should have general agreement, for example, on a tax system that is fair and that is simpler, that people can understand, and that provides fewer benefits in the form of loopholes for those who can afford to use them. I think, for example, if you look at one of the American predicaments or problems, you see it embodied in a Daniel Yankelevich poll in 1980, in which he asked the American public, do you think if you abide by the rules in America that you'll get ahead? And 81% of the people said no. And they said no, I think, in part because they were thinking of that tax code, the set of rules that, you know, some people abide by, others legally avoid, others evade. You have all kinds of, you know, unfair and uncertain application of the law, and we can cut through all that. See, the remarkable thing is here we can make the code a lot fairer, get rid of all these loopholes that people have been using to pay no tax, And at the same time, if we will be willing to get rid of those loopholes, we can drop the tax rates for all Americans. I mean, think of the working families out there that are paying 60, 40, 30% in income taxes. And under this approach, the maximum they'd be paying is about 14%.
Who's your opposition on the fair tax bill?
Well, every interest group that has its thing in the tax code comes before us and argues that if you get rid of ours, we have a depression, which I think you got to apply some common sense. Clearly, you won't have a depression. All we're doing is going back to the form of the income tax that Woodrow Wilson first put in the early 20th century, a basic tax of 14% with a progressive surtax, getting it up to 30%. And I think it's important to retain that element of progressivity, that if you have more, you should pay a little bit more in America. And, you know, I can understand people who, when tax rates were 50 or 70%, went to the political process, to me on the Finance Committee, to somebody else on the Ways and Means Committee, and sought their little exemptions in the law that would reduce their effective tax rate. I can understand that. Those people weren't bad. They were trying to get lower tax rates. But the price for all of these special interest groups getting their special little provision means higher tax rates for everybody else, because your tax base has narrowed dramatically. And basically the proposition we're putting to the American public with this bill is that the general interest, everybody's interest, is served by lowering tax rates and getting rid of loopholes. And that even those who now benefit and have a low effective tax rate in the long run would be better off, because they wouldn't have to spend all their time figuring out how to lose money to pay less taxes. They could actually do what they do well. For example, the other day, I was doing a statewide news conference on a radio, and a person called me up and said, you know, I really think you got a good idea with that fair tax. And of course, I was pleased and said, why? And he said, because I was talking to my neighbor the other day. My neighbor thinks I'm crazy. We both have the same income. I pay a 38% effective rate, and he pays a 6% effective rate. And he thinks I'm crazy because I'm not spending all of my time figuring out how to avoid paying the tax. But the caller said, I think he was a chemist, I like doing what I do. I don't like to waste time figuring out how to pay less tax. I like to do what I do well and get paid for it and pay my fair share. And I think that that's what most of the American people feel. And I think that's why this does express the general interest.
U.S. Senator from New Jersey, Bill Bradley, is my guest if you're just joining us, and we'll be opening up the phones for questions and comments in a little while. Do you find it a conflict to divide your time between issues of direct importance to New Jersey and issues of a more national, international significance?
I think it's a constant balance, and I have spent a great deal of time and interest to New Jersey. I mean, you mentioned the Fort Dix and the Philadelphia Naval Yard. We also got a VHF commercial television station for New Jersey. We fought for mass transit dollars and succeeded. Just last week on an appropriations bill, I got $4 million for two sites to clean up radioactive wastes in New Jersey. And so, you know, you're clearly an advocate and you push to try to get New Jersey interests served. And I think we've done that effectively. On the other hand, you have also a responsibility as a United States senator, and occasionally those things conflict. For example, a couple of years ago, there was a big push for nuclear breeder reactors, and a firm in New Jersey was involved in that process, and they came to me and said, you should support the nuclear breeder reactors, because if you don't, we'll lose 150, 200 jobs in New Jersey. Well, my response, there's your perfect case. There's a conflict. And ultimately, you got to go with your judgment. And my judgment over the long term is that nuclear breeder reactor technology is harmful to the general interest, even though for that company it was in their interest. And so I went and against breeder reactor technology. And ultimately, I guess if you ask me what's my attitude, or not philosophy, but maybe philosophy toward this kind of conflict, it is that you aggressively serve your state's interest. At the same time, you remember what Burke said, which was that you're an elected representative elected to use your judgment. And early on, I decided that I would run for the U.S. Senate only once every 6 years and let my judgment and how I've used it over those 6 years determine whether I should be reelected.
One of the really important issues in New Jersey now is the toxic waste that are turning up in people's backyards and near their workplaces. What kind of legislation or other work do you think needs to be done to help stem that problem?
I think we need four things. The first thing we need is resources. You need more dollars to clean up the waste. I was an original sponsor of the Superfund bill in 1980, largely responsible for moving it through the Senate. I think we need to extend it, doubling the resources. Second, you need more time in order to get these toxic wastes. We're going to have 65 of our over 200 sites in New Jersey in some state of feasibility study or cleanup by the end of the year, but we can't have it all done by 85. Third thing, we need teeth in laws against those dumpers who dump illegally. And fourth thing is you need information to flow from experts in the field to those who are making decisions in the field, local public health officials. And to that end, today, as a matter of fact, at Rutgers, I sponsored a conference in which we had participants from local health offices in municipalities all over the state of New Jersey. And they came and exchanged views and got information from the Department of Toxicology at Rutgers. And the result is, I think, much better information flow. The Department of Environmental Protection participated in it. The Commissioner Huey was there. I think the result is that you get a better flow so that you're able, as a local official who's confronted with citizens who are frightened by the prospect of toxic waste contamination, you're able to explain better because you have the facts. You're able to explain what the risks are. And you avoid the kind of overstatement that produces scare and the understatement that leads people to believe there's a deception going on. You're able to communicate the facts. I think those are the four things, and today, as a matter of fact, we're working on the information transfer.
In states like New Jersey, I think residents are confused because they feel that on the one hand they want safeguards against toxic waste, but on the other hand, industry opposes some of those regulations, and industry sometimes suggests that those regulations will make it too expensive for them to stay or too expensive for new industries to locate in that state. And that means a threat of higher unemployment, which would have a negative effect, obviously, on people who need jobs in New Jersey. Again, that's a balancing act for someone like you. How do you balance those factors?
Well, I would respond by saying that while there is that trade-off as a logical possibility and sometimes is a real possibility, that it is often exaggerated, and that I think people have come to define their happiness in terms of an environment free from pollution. And the question is, how free from pollution? For example, today at the conference at Rutgers, one of the doctors from the New Jersey School of Medicine talked about a patient coming in to see him who had been exposed to dioxin and had a little red mark on his hand. And he said that he was worried about this, and so worried about it that he increased his smoking a pack and a half a day. And the doctor went on to point out that if you look at what are the relative health risks of those two things, the little red spot of dioxin is much, much, much less a threat to the health of that individual than was his decision to increase his smoking a pack and a half a day. And so the point is that you have to have a balance and you have to have enough information to be able to make judgments about how free from pollution should we have our environment be. And I would argue that we should try to do it to the maximum level possible. And I really think that one of the problems has been that we tend to view the environmental issues in little boxes. So you got some people at EPA that are enforcing Clean Water Act, some people Clean Air Act, some people Superfund. I think we have to integrate the whole thing into an overall approach, and we have to recognize that we're part of one ecosystem. And that although separate subdivisions of the EPA are responsible for keeping it clean, overall, there's no free lunch here. For example, the Clean Air Act says you got to have scrubbers on exhaust from power plants. Well, those scrubbers ends up taking the pollution out of the air and creating scrubber sludge, which then has to be deposited on the land, which then gets into the water. So ultimately, what we have to do is find a way of viewing the types of pollution as a whole and being able to isolate them and dispose of them.
Let's get back to the subject of energy. You mentioned before that you opposed the construction of breeder reactors. Where do you think research should be going now in energy, since different forms of energy have different kinds of pollution associated with them?
You know, one of the things that I've actually done is to take what I just said a few minutes ago about what the levels of pollution are. Let's take solid waste. We have a real problem in New Jersey about disposal of solid waste. Well, what we got passed was an amendment on the Energy Security Act that subsidized the production of energy from garbage. And so what is a liability now, garbage that is polluting, that you got to find some place to dump, and that it is expensive and is, as I said, a serious liability, can be turned into an asset, a low-cost energy source. And we have in the law now a bill that it's right there in the law that would subsidize the production of energy for garbage and thereby encourage municipalities and states and counties to get into the business of using their garbage to produce energy, which then could be a magnet for jobs.
Bill Bradley is my guest, if you're just joining us, Senator from New Jersey. And I'd like to open up the phones. If you have any questions or comments, our number at area code 215 is 923-2774. The number again is 923-2774. It looks reasonably likely, I think, that Reagan will run for a second term as president, and people are now trying to figure out who the Democratic candidate will be. Who looks like the front runner to you now?
I don't think at this stage there's a front runner. All of them are my friends. Most of them are senators. I think it's way too early to tell. I think that they're all out there running. And from my perspective as the senator from New Jersey, I'd like to see how many come to New Jersey, how often, and what they're saying about issues that are of importance to us, in particular toxic waste and mass transit and aid to our cities and education. And I would like to also see how they stay over a period of time as candidates. And so it's too early for me to say. I think they're, you know, all I run for re-election in 1984, and I could run with any one of them on a national ticket, me running for Senate, them at the top of the ticket, and feel quite comfortable.
Some people think that Mondale looks like the front runner now, but criticize him for being a little too wishy-washy to really win the support of enough of the American people to win over the Republican Party. What do you think about that?
Well, I've heard that criticism, and I think that it's much too early to tell. I think that the key thing about a presidential campaign is that it really does require staying power and require a long-distance runner. And a lot of times there are all kinds of pressures to give an immediate response to something or give what is a high visible response. And the long-distance runner opts for a less dramatic response. And I think that's not necessarily bad.
While we're on the subject of the presidency, I'll ask you the question that I think everyone who has interviewed you has asked. Do you think you would ever run for the president?
No, I don't. I love being United States Senator from New Jersey. I love the job, the Finance Committee and the Energy Committee. I love the diversity of our state. And I really look at public service as a part of our civic culture, that your job as a U.S. Senator is fulfilling a commitment to try to make your society a better place in which to live. And I don't view it necessarily as a ladder. And I think it's very important to be the best senator that I can be for New Jersey. That's what I've tried to do. That's what I will continue to do. As long as the people feel I've done a good job, I'll continue to have that opportunity.
Okay, well, let's take some phone calls. Our number is 923-2774 at area code 215. My guest is U.S. Senator Bill Bradley of New Jersey. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to comment on the Fair Tax Act that Senator Bradley introduced. And I'd like to start by saying that some of the tax changes that have been made under the TEFRA, the Tax Equity and Fiscal Responsibility Act last year, actually impacted more on the middle-income taxpayers than on anybody else, such as the cutback in the medical deduction. Under the Fair Tax Act, Senator Bradley's talking about reducing the employer contributions to qualified pension plans. Now, I'm a pension consultant, and I'm see- doing right now what TEFRA is doing to private pension plans. I think the emphasis is in the direction of less reliance on government-provided benefits and more on private pension plans. If we reduce the benefits that the corporations are going to get in making contributions to the pension plans, we're going to see pension plans provided by private industry drastically curtailed.
Do you want to comment on that?
Sure. I think that last year's TEFRA legislation is a very good example of how it's important not to just close the loophole, but also to reduce the rates. I think the lesson of the 81 and 82 acts was in 1981 we gave the biggest income tax rate reduction in our country's history. And in doing so, we precipitated very high deficits. 1982, we needed revenues, so we had the biggest income tax increase in history, the TEFRA bill that he's referring to. Now, the lesson from those two years of tax legislation is to close loopholes and cut tax rates simultaneously. Not a year. Don't wait a year while the deficit mushrooms, but to do it at the same time. And indeed, if we did make a change that the caller referred to, there is an offsetting benefit to that change, too, and that is it allows you to drop the tax rate even further. And I feel that in the fair tax, we have looked very carefully at the pension area. We have not taxed pension buildup. We have kept IRAs and KEOs free from taxation. And I think overall it is a very sound approach on the long term.
Okay, thank you for your phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, this is a question directed to both of you, but of course more to the guest because he's in the spotlight today. Have you ever read or are you aware of a work called To Have or To Be by Erich Fromm?
No, I'm not. I have not read it.
Okay, well, it's a very easy read, and I know that there is much on your mind. I realize you're a very involved person, but I cannot recommend it too highly to anyone who lives in 20th century America to read. I know that it's very profoundly affected my life, and I think anyone else who reads it would also be very profoundly affected and has much to do with the future that we're facing. So I just would like to recommend it.
Thanks for your comment.
Sure. I'll put it on my August reading list.
Okay. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air, and we're short on time, so please keep it brief.
Okay. I am very concerned about the appointment of Ruckelshaus as head of the EPA, and I'm quite aware of the problems of pollution as they apply to businesses coming and going and shopping around for states that have laxer pollution laws. Perfect case in point is with the Philadelphia Electric Company has marvelous magnesium oxide scrubbers on their coal plants that actually make don't pollute the water because they recycle the sulfur and sell it. And my question is it possible for you or any other environmentally conscious people in order to stop the flight of industries that say, well, we have to move to a state where the people will let us pollute the water more because it's cheaper. Is there any move in the Congress to promote legislation that would make pollution laws uniform throughout the country so that they can't burn, tons of high sulfur coal in Ohio, which blows over to Pennsylvania anyway, and people move there because their electric rates would be cheaper for their businesses?
Sure. The whole rationale for the environmental legislation of the early 1970s, clean air, clean water, resource recovery, solid waste disposal, the Superfund, was the exact point that you have made. It makes no sense to have environmental laws in one state and to have them much different in another state. So the purpose of all those laws was to set a uniform national standard, which they did. The problem that you allude to is really the question of acid rain and the level of sulfur in a particular facility. And we hope that we'll be able to get a national law on acid rain sometime in the next year or two that will address this exact problem. Because keep in mind, I don't know if you're from Pennsylvania or New Jersey, but New Jersey is further east than Pennsylvania. So that whatever blows through Pennsylvania blows into New Jersey, and I'm very concerned, and we have to keep a national standard consistent with the laws that are on the books now and that we can expand by adding the whole question of acid rain to the Clean Air Act, for example.
What do you think the likelihood is of getting a national standard?
Well, I think it's good.
Okay, let's take another phone call. My guest is Bill Bradley, Senator from New Jersey. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello. My question concerns arms control. And I've done a lot of reading on the subject, and particularly about Reagan's policies. And I don't know, my impression of it is that he's kind of sort of simple-minded and frankly frightening in his approach towards the arms policy, nuclear weapons policy. And I just wonder what your assessment of his current proposals are.
Well, I was very disturbed initially with the administration, with their kind of loose talk about limited nuclear war and not expressing any desire to negotiate with the Soviet Union at all. I think that that has changed somewhat, and I think that that was largely a result of citizens who decided that it was important to have a mutual, verifiable, and negotiated nuclear freeze and took the issue to the president and said, we have to have an arms control position. Now, since that time, the administration has come forward with several arms control proposals that, in my mind, represent progress. I think that we can't be sure that they'll produce results, however, and I think that it's not exactly a positive signal to continue to produce unnecessary weapon systems like the MX or the B-1 when we're negotiating with the Soviet Union in a way that shows that the production of those weapon systems really flow from a certain insecurity about the negotiating process. We should fund those weapon systems and the defense budget at a level that will assure our national security and not more. We shouldn't throw money at defense just like we shouldn't throw money at social problems. And then we should aggressively engage the Soviet Union in arms control negotiations. And I think it's a kind of common sense proposition that we're like the Soviet Union and the U.S. are like two people sitting across a table from each other. We have a gun pointed at each other. And if one pulls the trigger, the other will automatically pull the trigger. Both will be dead. Now, underneath the table, you can be kicking each other, but it's kind of common sense to talk about putting that gun down. And in my mind, we can be much more aggressive in the arms control area, and I think that I'd hope, although there's been some progress, there needs to be some more at the administration's level.
Thanks for your call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
I'd like to get back to the tax proposal again.
Good. I'll ask you to keep it brief, though.
Okay,
we're running out of time.
Two quick questions. One, what's the guarantee that once enacted, the proposal remains simple? And two, what happens to the corporate income tax?
Okay, last question. First, the corporate income tax, we do the same thing, lower rates and eliminate loopholes. On the corporate side, we have a single rate of tax, 30%. On the question about what happens if we get it passed, how will we keep it simple? It reminds me of the story that I tell frequently where I'm with my liberal and conservative friend, and my conservative friend says, it sounds like a great proposal. Drop those tax rates and eliminate those loopholes. But we know what you politicians will do. As soon as you get that passed, all those special interests will put back in their loopholes. And my other friend looks at me and says, no, what they'll do is raise the tax rates again. And the point is, both of those things are possible. But if we get through this battle, and it will be that, and get a much simplified tax system, I don't think that you're going to see a big move to change it, either to raise the rate again or to put back in loopholes. And if there is an effort, for example, to put back in a loophole, I have a vehicle that can frame the question of the general interest very clearly, and that is if you get a loophole, you've got to raise the tax rate. So you are voting to raise the tax rate on all Americans in order to pay the loophole. For the loophole, that'll be a benefit to a few Americans. And that's why I think that while anything is possible, once we go through this, once we get a new tax system that is fairer and simpler with lower rates and fewer loopholes, I think that we're not going to be facing a continuing battle to fight those interests and that would seek to return us to the present morass.
Okay, thanks for your call. That's all the time we'll have for phone calls today. My guest is Bill Bradley, U.S. Senator from New Jersey. You were facing the press during your basketball years, and that was the sports press. Now you're facing political writers as a U.S. senator. Would you compare your reaction to the political press and the sports press?
The political press is smarter, more sensitive, more understanding. No. I think that they both have a similar function. That is, their job is to report to their readers about the activity, whether it's sports or politics. The difference for me is that in sports, you communicate with your performance on the floor. What you said in the locker room was kind of secondary. In politics, communication is a part of everything you do, and therefore you are much more a part of a process in which the press is an integral part. And therefore, there is a much, in some senses, a much greater level of respect and dependence and one in which there's kind of mutual admiration and mutual criticism.
What do you think of the Debategate controversy going on now? How important do you think that is?
Well, I think that I don't think we should exaggerate it at this stage. I think there are some facts. I think it was appropriate to get the FBI to investigate it and give us those facts. And after they've made their report, we can see if there's something more than has met the eye.
You've been in politics. You've been in the Senate since January of 1979. Are there any distasteful aspects of politics that you've learn to swallow and put up with, but don't enjoy game playing that you have to do so that your bills get passed?
The part of politics that sometimes is tough is just the grind, the schedule. I mean, you know, you have 14, 16-hour days, day after day after day after day. And obviously you'd like to win all the battles. You don't win all the battles, so you have to cope with defeat as well as victory. And obviously you'd like to have people tell you that they agree with you on all issues. That doesn't happen. And that's a part of the process that you learn to accept. And you learn to accept because there is a larger issue here, which is public service. So I don't have any complaints about the job, about the opportunity to serve the people. I think that there are good days and bad days.
Okay, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much for spending some of your time with us on Fresh Air. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Terry. Enjoyed it.
U.S. Senator from New Jersey Bill Bradley has been my guest, and I want to thank our listeners who called with their questions and comments. It's 2 minutes to 5 o'clock, and we'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air in just a minute, but let's check in first with Shadow Traffic.
Good afternoon, everyone. Eastbound Schuylkill Expressway right now, a bit heavy from Spring Garden through University. A disabled vehicle blocking the left lane, average speed 5 to 20 miles per hour. So when you get down that way, move over to your right-hand side. You may save yourself a little bit of time. West Philadelphia traffic looks pretty good. Northbound 95, a little bit slow, about a half mile approaching the Ray Street merger. If you're westbound on Vine Street, it's slow between 10th and 13th. Inner drive left lane, a disabled vehicle. Eastbound Vine is slow between Broad and 10th. And on the Pennsylvania Turnpike eastbound, 2 miles approaching the Fort Washington interchange. Earlier tractor-trailer fire off to the side. The Turnpike eastbound is slow for 2 miles approaching that earlier fire. Westbound, just a minor delay. The left lane is open. The right lane should be reopened soon, but delays can be expected. That's Shadow Traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is John Brown.
The Shadow Traffic Report was made possible with a grant from Superfresh. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we begin the first of a two-part series on the Japanese-American internment camps during the Second World War. Part 2 will be broadcast Friday afternoon at 3 o'clock. Part 1 tomorrow afternoon at 3. Also tomorrow at 3:40, we'll be joined by the amazing Kreskin. At 4 o'clock, my guest will be former New York Times reporter Seymour Hersh, author of the new controversial book about Henry Kissinger titled The Price of Power. So that's at 4 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. I hope you can be listening. If you have any questions or comments about Fresh Air, we hope you'll write to us. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. Again, that's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. Ken Tucker contributed to this afternoon's Fresh Air. Joyce Lieberman was the technical director. Maeve McGoran is the production assistant. Danny Miller, the co-producer of the show. Abby Ginsberg gave us some special assistance this afternoon. My name is Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening, and I wish you a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where listeners supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Susan Stamberg with All Things Considered.
This is a devastating illness. The fact that you happen to have pimples or a rash is simply evidence that your skin is reflecting what's going on inside of your body.
Many illnesses are thought to be caused by exposure to dioxin, contained in Agent Orange, a defoliant used in Vietnam. A veterans group is now charging chemical companies with conspiring to hide harmful effects of dioxin. The story tonight on All Things Considered.
Also, the Supreme Court rules in favor of equal pensions for women.
Another court ruling could speed up the rate of executions in this country.
Reports of disagreement within the U.S. Arms Control team at the START talks.
Baseball Hall of Famer Joe Cronin remembers the first All-Star game.
On All Things Considered, first news.
This is John Hockenberry. The Supreme Court today ended this year's session with two major decisions and the announcement of a delay for another expected ruling. The court said that pension plans that offer different benefits for men and women discriminate unfairly on the basis of sex. The insurance industry has long held that because women live longer than men on average, pension plans should reflect that. The court ruled that employers are required to make sure pension plans are not discriminatory. In another controversial case, the issue of videotaping of television programs and U.S. copyright law was not decided. Without explanation, the justices said that case will not be decided until next session, after more arguments from attorneys. Finally, the court did decide a long-awaited case on death penalty appeals. A 6-3 decision gives lower courts the discretion to streamline clemency appeals for death row inmates. The court said it is not necessary for judges to grant automatic delays in executions when appeal petitions are presented. The High Court said courts can quickly consider the appeal without rescheduling the execution. This decision means there will apparently be no more appeals for convicted killer Thomas Barefoot. His case was taken up as a test for more than 1,100 death row inmates. The first application of the decision may be tonight, though. A Mississippi man's execution was stayed last week in anticipation of this decision. A New Orleans court is now considering whether to allow the state to execute Jimmy Lee Gray. His execution order expires at midnight tonight. A report published today by the Knight Ridder News Service indicating that there is dissension within the ranks of the U.S. arms negotiating team was denied today by the White House and the State Department. NPR's Alan Berlow reports that the official U.S. government position remains it's up to the Soviets to respond to the proposals offered by Chief Strategic Arms Negotiator Edward Rowney.
State Department spokesman Alan Romberg told reporters that the U.S. delegation is working well under Ambassador Rowney's leadership, and he denied the Knight Ridder report characterizing the U.S. delegation as being in a state of disarray.
The story is erroneous. Our negotiators in Geneva are working in a flexible and innovative manner in an attempt to reach a...